The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
So Michael D. Higgins, the president, of course, was speaking at the BT Young Scientist exhibition last week. And some of the comments he made in an address to students have garnered attention. He talked about a whole range of issues, but he talked about the value of science and having a fact-based view of the world and employing scientific methods to moral ends to a degree. That's my language, not his. But he also talked about the importance of responding to the use of science and a rhetoric that calls for war as a state of mind, including the recent appalling comments from NATO calling for ever more armament spending to be achieved. So Michael D. Higgins, in his address, calling for Or responding, rather, to that NATO call for an increase in defence spending as appalling. Shashank Joshi is a defence editor with The Economist, and he took to Twitter or X, however you want to describe it, and he said that disgusting comments from Ireland's president, detached from reality. We're in the middle of the biggest war in Europe since 1945, and Michael D. Higgins essentially suggesting we disarm in response to that. Shashank is with me now on the show. Shashank, you're welcome to The Hard Shoulder, and thanks a million for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Can you expand then on this idea that the comments were disgusting or detached from reality? What did you mean?
Yeah, I'm very happy to do so. Look, first of all, I need to stress this isn't about Irish policy. This isn't about unpicking or criticising the defence and security choices the Irish government's made. But there's a few things to bear in mind. It is Irish government policy at right now to work more closely with NATO. It's in Irish government documents, it's in your strategy documents. NATO's a partner, it's not the enemy. So first of all, we see the president attacking European partners. Secondly, we're seeing him describe NATO spending as the problem when NATO is responding to Russia's initiation of the biggest war in Europe since 1945, and in one in which Russia is spending 8% of its GDP on defence compared to a NATO average of less than 2%. And lastly, I'm just troubled, I'm disturbed by this rebuke, this attack directed against countries like Estonia, Poland, Lithuania, living in the shadow of Russian military power. They've just watched huge chunks of Ukraine be swallowed up, children deported, torture camps. And the response is not to criticize Russian defense spending, but to attack NATO spending. I just find that extraordinary.
Yeah, no, and again, listen, I wouldn't expect you to be kind of paying a huge degree of attention to everything Michael D. Higgins has said, but he would be critical of Russia and of what Russia has done in the world and of their defence spending and their ramping up of kind of armaments manufacture and investment in that country as well. I think what he found so objectionable, the comments made by Mark Rutte, the new Secretary General at NATO, was where Mark Rutte said, we should have the mentality of war even at the expense of investing in essentials, in education, social protection and health. And I don't think Michael D. Higgins would be alone in finding that slightly appalling. The idea that you might take from education, social protection or health to invest in defence.
I can understand that. I will say, though, if I look at my own country here, the UK, I've looked at though defence spending as a proportion of GDP, which was well above 3% in the 1980s, has fallen down and down and down, falling below 2% relatively recently. Now it's just above. And spending on many other essentials of the state has gone up. And that's understandable. But it is imperative to see the context of this, which is this is not 1995. This is not 2005. This is genuinely a Europe in which Russia has invaded, in which we have obligations to our allies, in this case, the UK, to countries like Estonia and others, and in which we cannot meet those obligations and keep those countries safe from invasion, from attack. And we've just seen cables being severed in the Baltic, by the way, Irish cables also potentially vulnerable, without a greater investment in defence. And yes, that does involve trade-offs. So I don't think anyone should denigrate spending on welfare or education or health. I think that would be problematic, and I understand that. But I think Rutte is right that Europe is at risk. I can give you numerous examples of Russia putting, for example, explosive packages on airplanes across Europe as part of its hybrid campaign of sabotage, threats to assassinate vaccinate defence industry officials in Europe. And I don't think we should be ashamed of saying that actually it's okay to have a mindset that says Russia has waged war on Ukraine, threatening a shadow war against Europe, a potential bigger war in Europe down the line if it wins in Ukraine. And there's nothing shameful about being ready for that, I think.
But can you have deterrence and disarmament coexisting? Is that possible?
Deterrence and disarmament.
Yeah, disarmament. I know it kind of sounds counterfactual or counterintuitive, but I'm just thinking of things like, say, nuclear non-proliferation treaties, which would have been kind of signed at the peak of the Cold War. So you absolutely had kind of deterrence existing at the same time of disarmament in that context.
I think many advocates would agree with you, in fact, that in moments of tension, there is value in taking the edge off these conflicts. However, it has to be mutual disarmament. And let me give you one example on the nuclear front. We had a fantastic treaty called the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, signed by Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev in 1987. It eliminated an entire class of ground-launched medium-range missiles. That was a great treaty. That was an example of selective partial disarmament that made everyone safer. However, who was it who caused that treaty to collapse? It wasn't NATO. It wasn't Europeans. It was Russia who cheated on the treaty. And it's very nice to call for disarmament and to say, we all want that, of course. It's like calling for motherhood and apple pie and unicorns. We all like that. But let's look reality in the face and ask, if you want it, you must identify the reasons why we're not currently getting it.
We could kind of get lost in the weeds about the attitudes in Ireland to all of these things. And for our own peculiar reasons, we've never been a member of NATO. I mean, in some people's minds, we're entirely neutral. We're absolutely not entirely neutral from an objective sense. And I don't want to go down that road. So in a broader sense, what I want to ask you about is maybe the feeling of disquiet some people will have when they hear Mark Rutte talking about, the need for an increase in spending. And objectively, they might think, you know what, it makes sense. And I'm listening to everything Shashank is saying. And in that context, it sounds like we should be increasing defence spending. But the fear they'll have is that you find yourself in a situation where, to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And a mindset develops that if you have stuff, you'll use it.
I understand that. And we've been through 25 years in which we've engaged in some misguided wars that have not met with success. There's no doubt about that. I think actually people who served in militaries would be the first to agree with that. Iraq, Afghanistan and others. So you've got to learn from that. But this is different. These are not necessarily wars of choice on the other side of the world. These are wars in Europe, on the edge of Europe, coming to Europe brought by somebody else. And to give you one example of the trade-offs, in the UK, where spending, of course, as a proportion of national wealth has gone dramatically down over 30 years, we, the British Army, are unable to put out a single war-fighting division. And it's easy to say, well, so what? But the so what is that you can no longer provide a serious line of defence against these post-Soviet democracies that worked incredibly hard to get themselves out from the yoke of the Soviet Union. They became members of the European Union, allies of Ireland in that sense, and someone has to defend them. Mm. And you can't defend them at 1.9 or 2% of GDP when the Russians are spending about a third of their federal budget on the armed forces. We didn't ask for this arms race, but unfortunately, unless you can persuade Vladimir Putin that it's a bad idea, you cannot simply ignore it.
And what is the consequence of ignoring it? A worst case scenario? Is it Vladimir Putin suddenly kind of eyeing up the other versions of the Sudetenland that he sees around him, kind of Russian enclaves in other countries?
Well, it's not implausible. I mean, if I had told you 3 years ago Putin will invade Ukraine with the aim of extinguishing it as a state, you'd have thought I was crazy. And by the way, I'll just note, even this week, Nikolai Patrushev, who's a very close aide to Putin, a former head of their National Security Council, said, again, it's possible Ukraine won't exist as another independent country soon. He said the same of Moldova, by the way, another small, vulnerable European state. And the risk is ultimately that if he's successful in Ukraine, and right now he has the upper hand, that he may think, particularly if Donald Trump pulls support from Europe or is distracted in Asia or the Middle East, that he has an opportunity to break the European security order. And it's all very well for us, you know, if where I am here in London, to say, well, what's the other side of Europe? Who cares? But we again and again, we've seen that story that aggressors tend not to stop once they've whet their appetite.
The other reference to the Sudeten, that was a country in the world that, of which we know little about, as Chamberlain said. What impact do you suspect, and you kind of touched on it there briefly, but the incoming Trump administration and his commitment to NATO, I guess, is something that has been questioned by other members of that alliance. How do you suspect NATO might change over the 4 years of the Trump presidency?
I think that he is irritated and angry that Europeans are free riding on American military spending. And I think that for all of Trump's many faults, actually, he's right about that. And I think that a great many orthodox Republicans agree with him on that. In fact, Democrats agree. So I think that he's probably not going to pull out of NATO, though that is a risk. He probably isn't going to walk away from his obligations. But I think he will say, particularly at this summit coming up at The Hague, the big NATO leader summit in May, that, look, if you don't meet your spending targets, and he's will allegedly call for these states to spend 5% of GDP on defense, which no one thinks is realistic, no one thinks that will happen, then American commitment will be in doubt. And I think that he will use that as a cudgel to beat some of the lowest spending members of the alliance, particularly the big ones, you know, thinking here of Germany, and he will use that pressure against them. However, the bigger concern is not so much that. It's in the short term, it's whether he will throw Ukraine under the bus. And I think that's what gives NATO members is the biggest cause for concern.
Shashank, thank you very much for joining us. Shashank Joshi is the defense editor with The Economist.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.